Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Finimize podcast. I'm your host, Carl Haseley, VP of Content here at Finimize. And today we have a real treat for you. A roundtable with some of our analysts, the team behind the financial content you know and love across our app, website, newsletter, and of course, beyond, since you are listening to this podcast. Now, today we wanted to try something a little bit special, a bit of a wrap of 2023, and a look ahead to our best ideas for 2024. So in the studio with me, I am joined by Stéphane Renevier, Paul Allison, and Reda Faran. How are you guys?
Good, good.
Doing really well.
Phenomenal.
Fantastic. Let's dig into things. I think the biggest question I have is, what surprised you most about 2023? Reda.
Ooh, a lot of things surprised me in 2023. Maybe I'll just pick two very quick things. But first of all is the resilience of the U.S. economy. I mean, going into 2023, lots of talks about a recession never materialized. And really, that came down to the resilience of the U.S. consumer. And while that seems actually surprising at first glance, but if you look at the underlying dynamics and how much savings they built up during the pandemic, and they've kind of been drawing down those savings to keep on spending, kind of made sense in retrospect. But I think, yeah, that was definitely one surprise. And then another one were the wave of bank collapses at the beginning of the year. I mean, there's always that saying that, you know, the Fed will keep on hiking interest rates until they break something. They obviously broke something. But I think what really surprised me there was just the mismanagement at banks in terms of, you know, their assets and liabilities and how they were loaded up on all these long-term government bonds, clearly in the middle of a strong Fed rate hiking cycle. And they were seeing these mark-to-market losses and they were seeing depositors kind of withdrawing their money and really did nothing to kind of stop the bleeding. I just felt that was, you know, for running such a big bank, that was really bad mismanagement.
Yeah, I agree. I think one thing I've learned over my career so far is never underestimate the ability of a bank to find something else to get wrong in a way to tank its fortunes. Paul, what's...
I feel like you've teed that up beautifully for Steph to come in and say, well, none of that surprised me, of course.
No, it has surprised me. It has surprised me. But you know, to add to that, I think what has surprised me more generally, I think, is the long-term effect from COVID. And I'm not talking about the illness symptom, although we all sound pretty ill right now. But I think, you know, COVID really had a huge effect both on consumers and on companies. So, you know, if you look at consumers, you know, it really enabled them to basically build a very nice saving buffer. And I think that's what, you know, Reda was referring to. But it's not just consumers. If you look at companies as well, you know, during COVID times with interest rates at extremely low level, that really allowed companies to secure some long-term financing at very, very cheap rates. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen yet companies suffer from all of those aggressive rate hikes. But, you know, as they will need at some point to refinance, you know, the maturity wall will hit around 2025, 26. I think that's when we will really start to see the effect from those aggressive rate hikes. And, you know, one other thing that really surprised me obviously is the AI wave. You know, if you actually look at stocks performance without AI, you know, you look at small cap stocks, I mean, they're barely up this year. It's not been great. So what's really been the main driver? I mean, AI was a huge factor this year, and I don't think any of us was really predicting such a positive impact from AI. So that was definitely a big surprise.
A friend who is, you know, very influential in the tech and AI space often says, the future will be bright, the future's exciting, but it won't be evenly distributed. And I think markets this year have demonstrated that, you know, AI is exciting, but case in point, not evenly distributed. Paul, what else surprised you this year?
Well, I'm going to sort of somewhat copy Reda, but bring it down to profits. So, I mean, going into the year, I would say probably one of the more optimistic people going into the year when it comes to US profits. And if you cast your mind back to sort of this time last year, a lot of people were calling for quite a nasty earnings recession. I think Goldman Sachs at one point were looking for down 25 or 30% S&P 500 earnings. I was more optimistic than that, I must say, based on just my experience of how resilient US companies are, their ability to pass on costs, et cetera, and protect margins. But even I have to admit that I didn't expect S&P 500 earnings to actually grow this year. If you believe the most recent analyst forecasts, it looks like that's exactly what's going to happen. Very slight gain in S&P 500 earnings for 2023. And those same analysts are expecting next year to be a bit of a bumper year as well. 12% is the current consensus thinking for S&P 500 earnings growth next year. And if you basically consider that, you know, against the backdrop of rampant inflation, interest rates that have gone up faster than at any other time in history, that's pretty astonishing resiliency from corporate America. So yeah, I was more optimistic probably than most, but even that performance has caught me off guard.
Got you. So a lot better than expected across the board.
Pretty much, yeah.
As Reda said, some things much worse than expected. SVB, how are you doing? And obviously we've had things like war break out, but we did get a lot right as an analyst community. So I want to use that shard of light amidst the clouds of despair to turn our hand to 2024. How are you thinking about the year ahead? What are the strategies you have in mind? Paul, maybe starting with you, is it just long US again? What's the play? What do you think?
I'm still pretty bullish. It's harder to be as optimistic as maybe some points this year, given, you know, just how well the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ have done. I hear the argument of, you know, if you take the Magnificent Seven away, the index hasn't done anywhere near as well. But I kind of feel that's like saying, well, if Man City didn't have Erling Haaland up front, they probably wouldn't be as good as they are. So the fact of the matter is these stocks are a big percentage of the index, and that's what you're buying. Anyway, that aside, I'm still pretty bullish America, of course, but I'm actually adding a bit of Europe into the mix for 2024. It's probably the first time I've ever done that actually in a 20-year career. And there's two reasons for that. One, the one thing that niggles at me every time I look at the US is the ballooning fiscal debt situation, 120% debt to GDP, I think it is at the moment, election year next year. So there's no immediate plans to rein in any of that spending. And I would be extremely bullish if it weren't for that kind of tail risk that exists. And if you look into Europe, the debt situation isn't quite as bad. So for the EU area, I think it's about 80% debt to GDP. Germany, obviously, arguably the most important country in the bloc, 60% debt to GDP. That's incidentally come down by about 20 points over the last 15 years. Showing that you can actually practice a bit of fiscal discipline. And the other reason is I reckon that inflation is going to continue to drop. It's fallen pretty precipitously in Europe. I think that'll continue next year for structural reasons like higher structural unemployment, a less flexible labor market. So tie all that together, and I think there's a fairly strong chance that the ECB can start to aggressively cut interest rates at some point next year. And I reckon that's a pretty good backdrop for European stock markets, which I note are kind of flirting with all-time highs, even without AI pulling them up. So I reckon that's a fairly solid backdrop for European stocks to make some decent headway next year. So that's what I'm doing.
That's a reason to have a double take if ever I've seen one, which is the European debt situation is less scary than the US debt situation. Who'd have thought it?
Yeah, it's all about relatives.
Exactly. And to, you know, to quote Ray Dalio, macro drives everything. Registered trademark. So on to our multi-asset specialist, Steph. What are you seeing for the year ahead? How are you playing things?
Yeah, I think first, you know, I think investors generally tend to overly focus on their base case scenario. And it's like, I think it's going to be a soft landing. So, you know, I like stocks and I like et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is a bit the wrong way to think about markets. I prefer to think about the all of the different scenarios and the associated probabilities. And it's all about that distribution. And then you kind of compare that distribution to what's priced in markets. And that tells you kind of, okay, is the, you know, risk reward looking good or looking bad? What the market may be missing, et cetera. And I think right now, you know, investors are just super, super optimistic, both in terms of rate cuts, but also in terms of, you know, earnings growth. You look at valuations, et cetera. So I think there's massive optimism. That worries me a bit because I think actually in terms of, yes, it's possible. Even it's possible that it's the most probably scenario is that we see a soft landing at this point in time. But I think the risks of not having a soft landing and of having a hard landing is definitely higher than what the market is currently pricing. So at this stage, you know, when I see this much uncertainty, I don't like to take a concentrated bet on one outcome. I prefer to kind of, you know, spread my investments evenly across the different scenarios. So I like, generally, I like to have a sort of core satellite approach. So, you know, in my core portfolio, I try not to touch it too much. It's just basically a very long-term allocation. And this portfolio, this core allocation, I try to not make it too dependent on one specific economic scenario. So, you know, if you hold stocks, you're just basically, or if you hold stocks and bonds, you're essentially betting on a soft landing scenario. So, you know, I also own commodities in this kind of core allocation because I think, you know, an environment where inflation makes a comeback is actually a possibility. And that's a very bad environment for both stocks and bonds. So I like to have commodities. I like to own also some gold on the side of commodities. So I consider gold a separate asset, more like a currency than a commodity. And I also like to own some Bitcoin, you know, to hedge against some pretty extreme scenarios. So that's kind of my core allocation. And then, you know, I have this satellite.
Just for clarity, Bitcoin's in your core allocation.
Bitcoin is in my core allocation,
it's
yes.
Mine as well.
Wow, okay.
And then, you know, I like to have some satellite trades. And here it's really, you know, more kind of tactical views or even long-term views when I think the opportunity is very good. So, for example, you know, TIPS recently, real yields hit 2.5%. I mean, for me, you know, as in my long-term portfolio, if I can secure this this type of guaranteed yield on a, you know, 10-year basis, beating inflation plus 2.5%. I mean, this is a fantastic entry point. So in this case, for example, I pull the trigger opportunistically. So I've got all of these kind of satellite trades. Some are much more short-term. You know, like, for example, right now, I think volatility is very attractive. It means that, you know, I can hedge the risk in my core portfolio very, very cheaply. So that's something that I look at it opportunistically. I like gold as well, opportunistically. And then, you know, longer term, I love bonds. I love TIPS. So those are kind of more longer term trades. And, you know, I also have a lot of cash in my portfolio right now. I think, you know, you get paid a high amount in cash to basically wait for even better opportunities. So, for example, stocks, I think there will be a fantastic entry point. I expect a correction. I'm just basically waiting for that entry point. But I think at these levels, for example, stocks don't look too attractive in terms of risk reward to me. So I prefer to wait on the sidelines, getting paid 5% to wait and enter at a much better level.
I like the TIPS play. I'm guessing that, is that real yield? Probably that's about as good as you've been able to get on TIPS for a long time, isn't it?
Yes, 100%. I mean, it's amazing. If you think about TIPS, it doesn't always work, but I think when yields are so attractive, and you know, you're not just protected, you know, for inflation, but also for deflation, because, you know, your investment cannot go down the face value. So you always get back what you put in. So if you start to see a massive wave of deflation, well, it doesn't really impact your, you know, the value of your loan, because this is, it cannot go lower than what you've put in.
Cool. Reda, is 2024 a continued year for dual momentum, or should we be looking at other things?
No, that's a really good question. So I think, you know, if you look back at the past few years, there's obviously many, many things that drive markets, but there's always been kind of one key underlying thing that's kind of been driving markets sort of every year. So if you look at 2020, 2021, it was obviously COVID, shutdowns, and then when our government's going to reopen things, et cetera, et cetera. 2022, 2023 were the, you know, hangovers and after effects of all that. So the big spike in inflation and then the rate hikes necessary to tackle that inflation. Now, I think going into 2024, the main huge narrative kind of driving that are rate cuts. And actually, if you look at last month in November, stocks, bonds, gold, Bitcoin had incredible months. One for the record books in some certain cases. For example, US bonds had their best month in nearly 40 years. And that's all based on rising expectations of rate cuts. I think personally, traders have gone a bit ahead of themselves. They're starting to price in rate cuts as early as March, April, May, depending on which central bank you look at, and then aggressive cuts from there onwards. Central bank messaging is, guys, that's not going to happen. That's way too, we're going to keep rates high for longer. So I think that strong performance cross asset class that you saw last month could actually start to revert as traders wake up to the reality that, you know, central banks are not going to cut as aggressively as they think. I think there is one silver lining to that in the sense that if central banks do not cut interest rates, that kind of means that they perhaps believe that the economy is headed for a soft landing. Because when would a central bank cut interest rates? If you think about it, it's when inflation has gone down, the economic growth has taken a deep dive, that they need to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy. But if they have the luxury of keeping interest rates high, that means, okay, inflation has come down, but economic growth hasn't come down so badly that they now need to cut rates to stimulate the economy. So the silver lining is that might not be good for bonds if they keep interest rates high, but could be a good environment for stocks in that scenario because economic growth doesn't take a dive and profits don't take a dive.
And I guess the question then, or the thing to watch perhaps is, if I think historically, right, when central bank comes up against markets, generally markets win. So are traders actually getting ahead of themselves, or are they seeing something that the central banks are slow to respond to?
Yeah, I think you make a great point because there have been many points in history where central banks kind of had to cave in to kind of what the market was expecting, be it rate hikes or rate pauses and rate cuts. But I think this time, going past the past year and looking at what central banks have done with rate hikes, I think they've kind of been doing their own thing and actually going against market expectations in certain instances. And I think they can do that again in 2024. But you touched on dual momentum. And actually, if you think about it, momentum has worked quite well this year in 2023, in the sense that we talked about the big surprise in AI and how equities have surprised and staged this massive rally in 2023. But if you had a momentum strategy where, you know, you were in an asset class when it's trending up and out of an asset class when it's trending lower, that worked quite well this year because you would have got in on stocks, rode that wave, you would have gotten on gold, Bitcoin, which is the best performing asset this year, Carl, up 150%, more than 150%. And you would have avoided bonds because bonds have just been trending lower all year long and you would have not been invested in them. So actually momentum and the trend following strategy worked really, really well in 2023. That's the strategy I always prefer. But I'm also with Stefan, I am holding some cash because for the time being, up until central banks cut interest rates, you are being paid a high yield of 5% in the US to just wait. And there is quite a lot of uncertainty. And I think holding cash in the face of uncertainty is always a sensible strategy.
Carl, can I just make a quick related central bank point, which I think sometimes goes a bit missed. If you go back to 2019, sort of 2018, 2019, when the Fed tried to raise rates and there was those tantrums and everybody panicked, if you could have offered central bankers then what they have now, they would have bitten your hand off. They've got decent economies. They've got a reloaded interest rate gun for if economies stumble and equity markets are touching all-time highs. I'm not saying they focus solely on equity markets, but they definitely keep an eye on it. And kind of like positive backdrop, I know it's been tough and everybody says, you know, how difficult it has been to be a central banker this year. But genuinely, I think if they look back over this year, they would be thrilled at the position that they have and the hand that they have to play going into next year.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So we're coming to the end and I wanted to do a bit of a fun one. And we're going to go in order of most optimistic analyst to least optimistic, most pessimistic. So we're going to start with you, Paul, and then come to Reda, and then our resident bear, Steph. So the question is this. We've talked about sort of our central views or strategies for 2024. Or the benefits of not having a central view or strategy for 2024 in Steph's case. What's your 5% likelihood wildcard event that is in the back of your mind that could completely shift the earth from under you in 2024? And if that happens, what happens to asset classes? Now, the answer doesn't have to be I would buy this because, of course, we're long-term investors and that 5% thing might only have a three-month impact. But what happens in the world in that 5% wildcard scenario?
Well, I'm actually, for the resident bull, I'm going to give you a short, which is oil. And I reckon there is a not insignificant chance. It might not be next year, granted. It might be within the next couple of years, but probably give it a 5% chance for next year. Oil is going to halve, maybe even more. And I might be wrong on that actual price target, obviously, but directionally, I think I'll be right. I'm hedging my bets here. So, like, it won't be a surprise to you guys that I'm negative on commodities, particularly, you know, when they've been reasonably strong over the last 12 months or so. But at some point, this whole idea of peak demand is going to be taken more seriously. And I think that that makes for increase in discord in OPEC. And look, cartels work well when there's sort of stable to increase in demand and everybody's doing okay and people will want to control supply, etc. But I think once this whole idea of fairly dramatic decline in demand for oil starts to be taken more seriously, which I think it has to at some point because of the whole idea of the world going to electric cars, etc., then I think you're going to see lots of fights breaking out in OPEC. And I think there's a not insignificant chance that the whole thing kind of falls down like a house of cards and everybody just starts pumping oil to be the kind of last man standing. There's already been talk in the news of, you know, Saudi Arabia trying to flush the oil market to regain control because it's not happy with, you know, the US production where it is. And while ever oil kind of keeps ticking down, I think the chances of that happening increase. So that's my sort of wild card for next year. I think we could see crude prices back at kind of 30, 40 bucks. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's obviously not great if you're a member of OPEC. it's probably a good thing for inflation. It's a good thing for discretionary spending. It's probably also a good thing for markets outside, of course, oil companies. So generally speaking, I think that will be well received. And that is my 2024 wild card pick.
Woof, what a start. I like it.
You see the anger in the room.
I mean, the last barrel of oil in the world will be worth zero, but it's just the path. It won't be a straight line, because as soon as oil halves, then demand shoots up. But
yeah, I don't think it's going to be a straight line to zero from 30, but I certainly think there's going to be volatile along the way. But I don't think we're ever going to see oil price. We've already seen the record in a barrel of oil. I don't think we're ever going to go back to whatever it was, $120 or something like that. I think it will oscillate, but I think we're going to be on a downward trajectory from here for the next 20 years for sure.
All right. Redo.
I'll give two kind of short ones, and both energy related, and one the complete opposite of what Paul just said, actually. So if I look, and the question is purely on next year and what could be a 5% chance, if you look from a geopolitical point of view and what's happening in the Middle East, and now you've got, you know, the rebels in Yemen are attacking and hijacking these oil tankers and other shipping containers. They have in the past, I don't know if you recall, I can't remember when this took place, a year, 2 years ago, something like that. They attacked an Aramco oil facility as well, and they took a bunch of production offline. Now, I hope for the sake of the world that what's happening is contained and de-escalates really quickly, but there is a 5% chance, I would say, or perhaps more, that things kind of escalate a lot in the Middle East. And if that impacts, for example, Iranian oil flows or Saudi Arabian oil flows, which combined is a massive portion of oil flows, and then you get a big spike in energy prices, could be oil-related from the Middle East, it could be gas-related from Russia and the conflict there escalating, and you get this massive spike in energy prices, that could lead to a re-acceleration in inflation again, because energy obviously feeds into everything, right? Producing goods and whatnot. And then you get this re-acceleration of inflation just as central banks were doing a victory lap, and then are we looking at rate hikes again? So wildcard prediction, you know, I'm not saying that's my base case, that's a low probability scenario, but something to think about. The other one I kind of mentioned, also energy related. So Trump coming back in 2024, that is more than a 50% chance, yeah, arguably at the moment. But I think what would happen in that scenario is rip up once again all these kind of climate initiatives that Biden kind of had set during his presidency. And if people are following renewable stocks lately, they've been doing terribly, contending with massively increased financing costs, canceled projects, especially in the US. And then if you have this kind of Trump presidency who kind of removes all the cheap, what's left of the cheap funding for them, that really, really, really impacts these green energy companies, particularly in the US. And you start to see these wave of bankruptcies in developers from solar to wind, et cetera, et cetera. So that could potentially happen as well.
The only pushback I'd have to that is that would happen in 2025, but if Trump wins in 2024, markets will start to discount that in November. Okay, and Steph, are you going to surprise us all with a really optimistic 5% scenario?
NVIDIA is going to double.
No, I think there is a less than 5% probability of me giving you a very optimistic scenario right now. No, to be fair, I have also some low probability optimistic scenarios, but I think the one that investors should really pay close attention to is the risk of another financial crisis. I think, you know, the financial system has changed a lot since the crisis in 2008. And yes, banks are in a much, much better shape. The problem is that, you know, the risks are not with banks anymore. They've shifted to these non-bank financial institutions, you know, these shadow banks, private equity funds, private credit funds, insurance companies, hedge funds, etc. You know, these players are unregulated, they're opaque, they're very complex. They use a lot of leverage. They've got, you know, lots of mismatch between their liabilities and their assets, and that just means that, you know, we don't really understand quite well to what extent they pose a threat. So I think, you know, if you look at that, you're like, okay, it seems that the system is a bit more fragile than what we tend to think. And, you know, that's what happened also this year with the LDI crisis in the UK. You know, it hits you when you expect the least. So you always think we're safe until you realize it hits you somewhere where you're a bit, you know, unprotected, or you didn't really know the risks existed there. So I think, especially with financial crisis, you know, it's more about looking at the overall fragility of the system. And to me, you know, when I look at the overall system, I'm a bit worried, to be honest. And now, you know, you look at, you know, these private equity funds, the private credit funds, especially private equity funds that start to be a bit under pressure from these higher interest rates. So, you know, so back to my point, I think you have fragile system, and then you've got a few catalysts, I think, for kind of trouble to brew. You know, you've got these high interest rates. I think they haven't yet fed through the economy. I think it will take time. I think, you know, this year we will see some kind of more impact from these higher interest rates. So that could be one catalyst. The economy slowing down more than expected could be another catalyst. Risks in you know, commercial real estate, even residential real estate at some point could also prove a catalyst. And what really worries me is once those initial catalysts hit, it's all of this exacerbating factor with these shadow banks that you know, they're tightly linked, again, leverage, illiquidity, etc., that can really kind of exacerbate the moves. And I don't think that's something that, you know, investors are ready for.
So one very quick follow-up to that, because just recently we heard the CEOs of the big US banks, including Finimize Modern Investor Summit keynote Jamie Dimon, testifying to a Senate committee about the risks in the financial system. And certainly Jamie Dimon and a couple of others might have agreed, said that additional regulation on private equity is something they'd be in favor of. I think that was specifically around tax advantages. But do you think regulation accelerates those risks because they're probably not really well understood or appreciated? Or do you think that could actually take some of the juice out the system and actually calm things down and reduce those risks?
I think it's going to be a tricky, but I think ultimately it will help reduce those risks, but I don't think it will be without an impact that there is this sort of transition period. But also, I don't think this is a 2024 risk, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, you know, regulation takes time, and regulation is always, it's only looking after the fact at, you know, trying to solve the last problem. So I think, you know, the issue with regulation is it will always fix the previous problem, but never the one looking forward. So I think they will only really kind of look at shadow banks and make, you know, real changes once we've actually had a problem with those shadow banks. So yeah.
All right. And that brings this podcast to a close. Thank you to Paul Allison, Reda Farhan, and Stéphane Renavier. We'll be back soon. Have a great 2024.